Wasn't sitting still because I refused to stand up unless I get an introduction. Good morning, it is lovely to see you all. As you've just been told, my name is Paul and I'm one of the ministers here. And we are carrying on this morning in a series that we've been in for 3 or 4 weeks since Christmas, working through the Gospel of John, which is one of the four stories in the New Testament of Jesus' life. And so I'm going to read to you from John chapter 2. And the second half of that chapter, if you want to follow in the red Bibles, we're on page 1065, starting at verse 12. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So, he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here! How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" His disciples remembered that it's written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and are you going to raise it in 3 days? But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many people saw the miraculous signs he was doing, believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man." Here's an experience that I bet every single one of you have had at some time. When you feel like you know somebody really well, you've got an idea of what makes them tick. You know how they think. You know how they're going to react to things. You kind of know. You know how they're wired. And then that person, out of the blue, says or does something that is so far removed from what you expected that it totally changes the way you view that person. It's happened to all of us, hasn't it? At some time. Somebody that we know well, that does something that totally changes the way we view them. And it kind of blows our mental image of that person out of the water. And it forces us to create a new mental picture of them. It forces us to understand them in a new way. And this incident in the Gospel does that to our usual way of thinking about Jesus. We know all about Jesus, the compassionate healer. And we're quite comfortable with Jesus, the motivational preacher. And we're more than happy, normally, with Jesus, the divine miracle worker. That fits our understanding of who Jesus is. And then along comes Jesus, the violently angry man. And that's a mental image that is a little harder to get your head around. People, we don't seem to do it anymore, but people used to wear those bracelets. Do you remember those "What Would Jesus Do" bracelets that everyone used to wear 10 or 15 years ago in church? And the idea behind those, you had WWJD around your wrist or on a t-shirt or something else. And the idea behind it was that whatever situation you're in, you'd be constantly asking yourself the question, if Jesus was stood here in the situation that I'm in, what would Jesus be doing? Because that is what I shall do. The idea. I don't remember any time when somebody wearing one of those bracelets and asking themselves that question came up with an answer that involved a ball whip. It just isn't how we see Jesus. And it's a little uncomfortable thinking about Jesus in that way, isn't it? It doesn't quite fit. I want to know Jesus. And as far as it's humanly possible to do so, I want to understand him. And if you share that longing, then we have got to be open to the times that he said and did things that make us a little bit uncomfortable. We've got to be open to those. We've got to allow those times to speak to us and to change that picture that we have of him. Because the natural thing to do, and we all do this, is that we focus on the passages and verses in the Bible that we feel comfortable with. We all do that. And we come back to the ones that confirm what we already think, or that reassure us in what it is that we like to hear about God and about his ways and about ourselves. We come back to the ones that we're comfortable with. And we naturally tend to skip over the ones in which Jesus kicks his way out of the little boxes that we sometimes put in. But Jesus with a whip is the same Jesus that we've been worshipping and praying to this morning. And if our ideas of Jesus don't fit that, then we need to allow our ideas to get changed. Because it's the same Jesus. Turns out he never really was gentle Jesus, meek and mild after all. So what do we do with all that? Let's get into the story a little bit. Let's explore the story a bit more. And try and find out, well, what does it take to make Jesus that mad? What does it take to make Jesus that cross? I'd like you to try and picture the scene with me. And we're going to need to use our imaginations a little bit here. Jesus had grown up in a village called Nazareth, which is in an area called Galilee, and that was right up in the north of Israel. So he had grown up in a fairly remote area in the north. And the events in the passage that I've just read start very close to where he'd grown up. They're actually in a village called Capernaum, which was also in Galilee, so also up in the north of the country. And Capernaum was a little fishing village on the shores of Lake Galilee. But when it came round to the Jewish festival of Passover, it says they went to Jerusalem. They went up to the big city to celebrate Passover, to have the big religious festival. And that wasn't like us walking to West Key. For where they were, down to Jerusalem, which was much further south in Israel, was a walk of over 85 miles. That's further than it is from here to London. It was a long way. It was a big deal to go there. But they did it, and they did it every year, because if you really wanted to meet with God, that could only happen in one place, and that was the temple in Jerusalem. And so every year, it wasn't just Jesus, every year, a huge proportion of the people from across the country would descend on Jerusalem. And so whole villages would go together. And it would take days to get there, it would take days to get back again. It was a huge effort. In some ways, it was a real ordeal. But it was what you did to worship God. And then when they arrived in the city, it would have been absolutely heaving with people. And the narrow streets would have been packed with traders and with market stalls and thousands of Jewish people who had come there for the festival. And alongside the Jewish people, of course, there had been hundreds of Roman soldiers trying to keep order in this suddenly overrun, packed city. It was going to be very, very different from the villages and the countryside of Galilee that they travelled from. And as they pushed through the crowds, they would have caught their first glimpse of the temple. And it would have looked glorious. Actually, it wasn't even finished. They'd been building it for 46 years, and it still wasn't completely done, or rebuilding it. But it was already huge, and it was already seriously impressive. The outer courts of the temple were the size of around about 35 football grounds, if you can try and imagine what that looks like. And the temple was designed... do you know what Russian dolls are? A doll inside a doll inside a doll. There was something a little bit like Russian dolls about the way the temple was built. They had courts within courts within courts. It was like layers that you went into. And you, as you went in, the further you went, the more exclusive it became. And so the outermost court was open to anybody, from anywhere. Anyone could go into there. And then after that, you could go into a court where only Jewish people were allowed to go. And then if you went on further, you'd come to an area where only the Jewish men were allowed to go. I'm sorry, ladies, it just wasn't a very enlightened time, but that's the way it was. So you came to a court where only the Jewish men were allowed to go. And then after that, an area where only the priests were allowed to go. And then you would come to the holy place, where only those priests that were serving were allowed to go in to perform particular rituals. And then right in the heart of the temple was the Holy of Holies, where only the senior priest was allowed to go, and he only was allowed to go there once a year. And the central building in the middle of the temple, so where the holy place and the Holy of Holies was, it was enormous. It was the height of a 20-story building. And the whole thing was covered in white marble. It was clad in white marble and gold. And they said that you couldn't even look at it in the sunshine because it reflected so much, it was dazzling. And this was the centre of the Jewish religion. It was the absolute heart of their faith. And it was huge and it was strikingly beautiful, and they were proud. And in walks Jesus with a cat of nine tails, and absolute chaos ensues. And he herds the animals that were being traded in the outer courts and herds them out of the temple. He overturns the tables where they were changing money, and no doubt crowds of people scrabbling after the coins as they bounced across the ground. The very heart of Jewish worship. And Jesus was in. So here's our question. What kind of religion makes Jesus mad? What kind of religion? What was it about what he saw? What kind of religion makes Jesus angry? I've got three answers. Here's the first one. Jesus gets angry at selfish religion. They were treating the poor with contempt. Basically, people were getting ripped off. When you came into the temple, people were getting ripped off. When you visited the temple, you had to pay a certain amount of money towards the upkeep of the temple. It wasn't like us taking up an offering here where you can put something in or not put something in and it's completely up to you. It was mandatory. You were expected to pay a certain amount towards the upkeep of the temple every time you went in. And they called it the temple tax. And there was a catch with the temple tax. And the catch was that you had to pay it in Jewish currency. But Jewish currency wasn't in use in Israel anymore because the Roman army had come in and they had banned Jewish currency. And they brought in Roman currency. And you could still use Greek currency, but you couldn't use Jewish currency anywhere else in the country. So the only place that Jewish coins were used, the only place you could do anything with them was in the temple. And so they had money changers, just like we had at the airport if you're going to another country. But the money changers were making an enormous profit. Nobody was going to come in with any Jewish money in their pockets because nobody could use it anywhere else. And on every transaction, they would charge something like a full day's wages just for the privilege of changing your money into the kind of coins that you had to use to pay the temple tax. Not only did you have to pay the temple tax when you went to the temple, but you were supposed to bring an animal for sacrifice. Except that it had to be a healthy, unblemished animal. No animal that was unwell or that had any sort of marks or blemishes on it could be used as a sacrifice. And they had inspectors. And the inspectors would check each animal. And if it wasn't up to scratch, you'd wasted your money buying that animal because it couldn't be accepted for a sacrifice, and so you just had to, I don't know, take it home or set it free or whatever, but you couldn't use it for a sacrifice. And you were perfectly welcome to bring your own animal from outside the temple. You could do that, no rule against it, no problem. Except that the inspectors worked for the temple. And the people selling animals inside the temple courtyard also worked for the temple. And if you bought a pair of doves inside the temple, it would cost you 20 times more than it would cost you just outside the temple gates, but they would guarantee that it would pass the inspection. Can you see where the con was? It was all an enormous rip-off. And what made it worse was that it was being done in the name of holiness. It was being done in the name of God. But they weren't serving God. They weren't serving other people. They were simply helping themselves. And self-serving religion never pleases God. Self-serving religion never pleases God. God spoke through Isaiah, who is one of the prophets that has a book of his the things that he said in the Old Testament. God spoke through Isaiah about what faith is meant to look like. This is in Isaiah 58, if you want to look it up. It says this: "Isn't this the kind of fasting that I've chosen? To loose the chains of injustice, and to untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free, and to break every yoke. Is it not to share your food with the hungry, and provide the poor wanderer with shelter, when you see them naked, to clothe them? And not to turn away from your own flesh and blood." And I wonder whether our understanding of worship has sometimes become a little bit too narrow. When somebody helps in a soup kitchen, serving the homeless, or when somebody goes out on a Friday night working as a street pastor, isn't that an act of worship? When we do something like Love Harefield and spend a Sunday going into the community and doing things to serve rather than getting together here and having a service, isn't that an act of worship? When somebody chooses to pay a little bit extra so that the chocolate that they buy or the tea or coffee that they buy has been fairly traded, and so that there's a better deal for the poor people at the far end of the trading that actually get a little bit of money out of it rather than getting ripped off themselves, isn't that an act of worship? When somebody gets involved in campaigning for an end to human trafficking, there's more slavery in the 21st century than there was 200 years ago when it was abolished. When somebody gets involved in campaigning for an end to that, and an end to young girls being trafficked into the sex trade, isn't that the kind of worship that pleases the heart of God? Isn't that true religion? I'm not saying we should stop what we're doing here, but isn't that as much a part of it as what we're doing here on a Sunday morning? If we fail to do what we can do to meet the needs of the poor and the hurting and the needy, whether they're at the other side of the world or whether they're 100 yards away from this church building, if we fail to embody God's love to those who need it, what value is our faith? What value is our faith? If my faith isn't serving others, then it isn't serving God. Jesus gets angry at selfish faith. The second thing that I think he gets angry at is empty religion. They weren't just treating poor people with contempt, they were treating God with contempt. The temple was supposed to be a house of prayer. It was supposed to be a place where anybody could come and meet with God. And they filled it with farm animals and businessmen. And by focusing on the rules and regulations of their religious practices, what they've done is that they've taken the focus away from meeting with God and turned worship into a series of rituals, a series of just going through the motions. And you know, it's possible for us to get so absorbed with the paraphernalia of religion that we lose all sight of its real meaning. We lose all sight of what the heart of it is. They have all the right rituals, they have religion coming out of their ears. But they seem to have lost God at the heart of it. And there really is nothing more tragic than empty religion. Nothing more tragic than faith that focuses on the externals and misses the heart of what it's all about. When we were at our very first placement church, when we were training for ministry, the minister who we were working with showed us a letter that had come from somebody in his congregation, and this lady had written to him about something that was obviously close to her heart, and the fact that it was close to her heart wasn't a problem. She wrote and said, "Please, please, don't get rid of our beautiful pews." Fair enough, that's a perfectly valid opinion. But then she went on and said this: "Church just wouldn't be church without them." No. Church wouldn't be church without the presence of the living God. Everything else is negotiable, isn't it? Church wouldn't be church without the presence of the living God. And it's easy for us in a church like this to get a little bit arrogant and think, well, that kind of thing, that couldn't happen to us because we're not very traditional, we're not very formal, we don't have many rituals, so we're not likely to get too absorbed into those sorts of things. But we can still so easily slip into making something that isn't the main thing feel like the main thing. We can still do that. We can fall into loving something about the way we do church more than we love Jesus. And before we know it, we are inspecting other people's dust to see whether they're burnished. I know that's pushing the metaphor a little bit, but you understand what I'm saying. It's so easy for us to fall into making something that is not the main thing seem like it's the main thing. If I had to finish the sentence, church wouldn't be church without, what would I put in the blank? What would you put in the blank? And if the honest answer is any of the fixtures and fittings of church life rather than the presence and the person of Jesus, then we need to come back to him again and we need to choose to make the main thing the main thing. So Jesus gets angry at selfish religion. He gets angry at empty religion. I think the third thing in this passage is that he gets angry at unwelcoming religion. You see, they were treating outsiders with contempt. Remember, if you go back to that Russian dolls thing and the way the temple was laid out, the courts within courts, the area that had been filled with animals and with people trading money was the outermost court. It was the one that they called the court of the Gentiles. And that was the only place that somebody who wasn't Jewish was able to go within the temple. So if Gentiles, like most of us, had rocked up at the temple, we'd only been allowed to go into that outermost court. That was where we had to go to meet with God. That was where we were allowed and able to have an encounter with a living God. If we tried to go any further into the temple, the consequences would have been really unpleasant and quite terrible for us. We were only allowed in and out of it. And this comes right back to what it meant for the Jewish people to be God's people. And actually what it means for us now to be God's people. They knew that they were God's chosen people, but they seem to have forgotten what it was they were chosen for. Again, in Isaiah, in the Old Testament, God spoke to the people and he said this: "I've called you in righteousness," and there's a little bit that I've skipped out, but it was all one long sentence. "I've called you in righteousness to be a light for the Gentiles." The reason he'd chosen them was to be a light for the people that didn't know him yet. And a bit later, also in Isaiah, he said, "My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." God's people are God's people because he has chosen us to welcome others into being God's people. Can I say that again? God's people are God's people because he has chosen us to welcome others into being God's people. And sometimes we act like he's appointed us to be bouncers at the door. We've been chosen to welcome other people in. Church isn't a members-only club. It's not a closed society. That's not what it's supposed to be. I know it's been said loads and loads of times to the point that it's probably become a cliche, but it is still true. Church is the only organisation which exists for the benefit of non-members. You You've probably heard that said 100 times, but it is true. Church is the only organisation that exists for the benefit of non-members. And so if we do what we do in ways that fail to make visitors and newcomers welcome, or in ways that prevent them from being able to meet with God themselves, then we're just selling livestock in the temple courts. A church that doesn't welcome anyone from the outside that wants to come in actually isn't a church. And so Jesus gets angry at selfish and empty and unwelcoming religion. But his words a little bit later in that passage turn the tables over far more than his actions at the beginning. Because having marched into the temple, which was the centre of the Jewish religion, as I said, the place where you had to travel to meet with God in a meaningful way, and having found it wanting, and not surprisingly, at that point, the Jewish people had one or two questions that they wanted to ask him, and he answered those questions by saying this, that he is now the temple. The presence of God on earth isn't a building anymore. The presence of God on earth isn't a place you have to make a pilgrimage to anymore. It is Jesus himself, who is Emmanuel, who is God with us. And real religion, real faith has changed forever from travelling to a particular building and performing certain rituals into having a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Because he is now the temple. And so if that picture of Jesus becoming angry is a difficult one for you, I want to encourage you to wrestle with it anyway. I want to encourage you to come to terms with it, because he is passionate about his church. And he is passionate about his people, and that's us. And I don't believe he stays angry with us, that's not his nature. His nature is grace and forgiveness, followed by more grace and more forgiveness. That's who he is, that's what he's like. But he calls us to a faith which is selfless, not selfish. And he calls us to a faith which is focused on relationship with him, not on empty ritual. And he calls us to a faith which is always embracing outsiders and making them insiders, not ever being unwelcoming. And the Jesus that we encounter in the temple reminds us just how passionately he would oppose any other kind of faith. Let's pray together, shall we?